this
tape
to
side one. We are interviewing Mr. William Block, the Post Gazette, in his office. Would you continue, Mr. Block?
Where were we?
I was asking you about when you entered the Army.
Oh, yes. March of 41. And I was drafted in from Toledo, where I was working at the Blade, and first went to 5th Corps area headquarters in Columbus, because that was so early in the draft period, they didn't have the training centers organized yet, so you were assigned directly to a unit. And I was assigned to the intelligence section, the S2 section of 5th Corps area. And it turned out that my bosses were, one was an editor from the evening paper in Columbus, the Citizen, and the other was the managing editor of the morning paper, both of whom had the idea.
Okay.
The day that I was drafted, my brother called me to tell me that my father had inoperable cancer. And we discussed whether it would make sense for me to ask for a postponement or something of that nature, and decided that we would have to talk about his illness. And he didn't even, I think, really comprehend what was wrong with him. I don't think he was told or really knew. He hated the discussion of illness anyway, and of death or anything like that. So I don't think he had much information about his own condition. And so I went ahead and was drafted that day. But when I got down to Columbus, I told these officers who I worked under and who were, of course, journalism people and who knew my connections at the Blade in Toledo, I told them about the situation. And they said that the colonel, regular Army colonel who headed this department, had some very good contacts with First Army, and maybe he could get me transferred. So sure enough, in May, I was transferred to First Army headquarters at Governor's Island. And that's when, you know, I started to live at home, because you were allowed to do that before Pearl Harbor. So, but of course my father was very ill at the time, and they were giving him morphine, I think, for pain and so forth, and so he wasn't with it very much. And it was pretty depressing. And as I told you, on June 22nd, which was a Sunday morning, while I was reading the paper about the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, he died. And I asked for, well, I had asked for a furlough, because they told me he only had a few days to live. And so I was on furlough, and we had a funeral, funeral service. The funeral service was at Temple Emmanuel in New York. And he's buried, my mother built a mausoleum at the Kensington Cemetery in Valhalla, New York. My mother lived 40 years after my father died, and she lived to be 98 and died in 1981. She was a widow all those years, and she bought an apartment in New York in a building across Park Avenue from where she had lived a number of years before. And she was at 550 Park or something like that. And across the street was 555 where we had lived before. And she bought an apartment there, cursing all the time that it was too expensive. I think it cost her about $25,000. Of course, she bought it during World War II. And
Was she well?
Oh, she was in fine fettle up until, I would say, the last 3 or 4 years of her life. She was amazingly sturdy, very sturdy. And that's about the story about my father and mother and the ends of their lives. What next would you like to discuss?
Well, now you were back in the Army.
Oh, well, in April, I think it was, of 1942, I went to Officer Candidate School at Camp Davis, North Carolina, anti-aircraft school. I knew nothing about, I had had no connection with the military service. I knew nothing about weapons or anything like that. So when I was in First Army Headquarters, we were on maneuvers in North Carolina in November of 41, just before Pearl Harbor. And I was on the night shift. I was in the G2 section of First Army, which is the intelligence section. So we, G2 section keeps the map of the operational map, which shows where the enemy is and so forth, and analyzes all the reports that come in from intelligence from the divisions and so forth, and maintains a situation map. And General Drum, who was the commander of the First Army, he used to come in to check the map, come in late at night, and so forth. And I was on at night, and I was on with a Captain Smoak, S-M-O-A-K, I think. And he was an anti-aircraft officer on temporary duty with First Army Headquarters. They added some people during the maneuvers. And he talked to me about anti-aircraft, because I didn't know anything about any of these military services. So when I applied for Office Candidate School, I thought, well, Smoke talked this up pretty well, I'll apply for it. So I applied, and I was accepted for a class in April of, I think it was April of 42. I was at Camp Davis, North Carolina, which was near Wilmington, North Carolina, I believe. And in June, I graduated as a bright, bushy-tailed second lieutenant, and was ordered to report to Camp Stewart, Georgia, later in June. I had about, I think, 10-day leave. And when I reported, I had roomed with a chap named Hawkins. And Hawkins was ahead of me in line, and Hawkins was asked by the personnel interviewer at the training center there, which gun he was interested in, and he said the 40 millimeter. That was the gun that was developed by the British, and which we were using a great deal in anti-aircraft, especially in mobile units. He was assigned to a unit that was already alerted to go overseas. He was engaged to be married to a young woman he had met while he was an enlisted man at Camp Davis. And he was given 3 days to go get married. While he was with her, and they were, I guess they were married. He was called back because they were leaving. I think they might have had 2 days together. And then he came back and they shipped out. They went to England and were in the North African campaign and up through Sicily and Italy. He was badly wounded in Italy, brought back to the U.S. to a hospital in the U.S. where his wife joined him, and he died a few months after he came back. I, who was standing right in back of him in that line, when I was asked what gun I was interested in, I said the 90-millimeter gun, which was the bigger gun that is used. I was assigned to a unit, which was the first effort on the Army, apparently, to do some integration. They had a regiment, an anti-aircraft regiment, all black enlisted men, black warrant officers, black chaplains, and all white officers. And I became the S2 of that regiment, and later the personnel officer of that regiment. I guess I ought to tell you the story of how I was kicked out of that regiment.
Sounds interesting.
As I say, I was the S2 and sort of assistant adjutant. And the adjutant was a man named Major Clayton, C-L-A-Y-T-O-N. And Major Clayton would go in to eat early, and I would have to stay until he got back. Well, we were alerted for overseas in the fall of 42. I'm a little hazy about the actual date, but well, we had the colonel had been operating an officer's mess. But that was not in the table of organization. So as soon as we were alerted for overseas, he closed down the officer's mess, and every officer had to eat in the battery, what we call battery, which in infantry would be called company, in the battery to which he was assigned. So I was in regimental headquarters battery. And when I came in late, the first day that they operated this mess, the first table was taken with the colonel and his operations officer and so forth. There were a number of them. At the second table were the two Negro chaplains and a young lieutenant who had been attached, a young black lieutenant, big, handsome young man, who had just been assigned to, attached to our regiment. He wasn't assigned there, but they had to find some place for him, and he had just arrived in camp, and they attached him to us. Well, I sat down with them, and I started to, I got food, and then started to eat. When the battery commander came in, he's the commander of the regimental headquarters battery. His name was Moses, Captain Moses, and he was from Mississippi. And he came in and took a look at the situation and told the two chaplains and the young lieutenant to move to the third table. And then he sat down with me. So the next day, a similar situation occurred. But I was officer of the day that day. And as officer of the day, you carry a pistol, and you're supposed to have a little more power, I guess. And so I was feeling my oats a little bit more. But anyway, same situation, first table full, second table, chaplains are there, the young lieutenant, and I'm sitting there when Moses comes in. And he ordered them to move. And I said to him, Captain, don't you think we ought to fight one war at a time? And he looked at me with a certain disdain. And I think he obviously was not pleased with that comment. Well, at the other end of the hall of this Squonset hut, where the enlisted men were lining up to get their food with their mess kits, they started to beat them with their knives and forks and beat these things. And they obviously knew what was going on. And this is an all-black enlisted men group. And they started to make a good deal of noise and pull away. They were not going to come into the mess hall. The colonel, seeing this, says to Captain Moses, call a meeting of the battery. Well, he didn't have to call a meeting. They were all going to the battery, to the commons room or whatever it was of the battery. So the colonel goes there. Oh, meantime, the young second lieutenant had walked out, and I walked out. I didn't stay there, and I went down to a friend of mine and had a marvelous meal somewhere else. So I wondered about the second lieutenant, where he could have gotten fed. I don't know. Well, the battery all assembled in the orderly room, and the colonel went there, and he gave them a big fight talk about here we are alerted for overseas, great opportunity, and this is a unique unit, and we must be the shining light, and so forth and so on. He gave quite a fight talk about this. And I have to say to you that he was a colonel. He was a full colonel of the regular army with a very low number. And all of his fellow officers of those low numbers were brigadier generals or better. So he could taste the importance of this whole thing, because his chances to be a brigadier general had to do with this unit sticking together and passing the necessary tests and being ready to ship out. And he must have seen this vanishing as he saw these men pull out of here. So he goes back to the orderly room, and he, after giving them the talk, he says, now what are you complaining? What's wrong here? What's wrong? And he kept asking this. Finally, you see, I was then personnel officer, and I had a battery clerk from every battery who kept the records and so forth. And I had, from regimental headquarters battery, I had a very big, slow-moving Texas kid who was a likable kid, but who wasn't the greatest battery clerk that ever entered the army. Anyway, after the colonel had asked for some time, what's wrong here, he said, Colonel, he said, I'll tell you what's wrong. He says, because I know what's going on. He says, Lieutenant Block tells me I've got to know everything that's going on in the battery so I can do my job. And he said, you want to know what's wrong? We don't like the battery commander. It was a roar, you know. So that's all I ever heard about that meeting. The next morning I was transferred out of the unit. The young lieutenant was kicked out. I mean, he was detached. He had been detached. He was detached. And I never went back to the unit. I was reported to the training center. And I finally was transferred. Well, I went to a school at Camp Davis. I also went to a... I was not on a table of organization. I was under orders from the training center. I went to a searchlight Air Corps, because, you know, we didn't have radar yet. Searchlight and Air Corps meeting to discuss the operations between airplanes and searchlights and so forth, which was in Orlando. And finally, I got transferred to Camp Hahn, California, near Riverside. Hahn is H-A-A-N, no longer in existence. And we were a cadre. I was assigned to a cadre to start a new anti-aircraft unit. Well, we were beginning to get control of the air throughout the theaters of operation. So they suddenly decided that they didn't need any more anti-aircraft units. And so we hung around waiting for this unit to be activated, and it never was. And then the order came through to disband these. There were a number of cadres for new units there. Disband them and assign them to an overstrength pool, and also to strip the overstrength from all the other units in the camp. All units were allowed about a 5% overstrength. In case they were ordered to leave for overseas, they had illnesses and other problems. That they would be able to fill each position and then leave the rest at the camp when they left. So they suddenly had a huge cadre pool that they put together. And they were looking around for people to run it. And unfortunately, they found I had been a personnel officer at Camp Stewart, Georgia. So suddenly I was the personnel officer of this whole kit and caboodle, and we had, I don't know, 10,000 troops thrown in on us almost overnight. It was a nightmare. And we had a little lieutenant colonel who was in charge of this thing, who was a terror to work for. But anyway, a few of us did get the thing organized in pretty good shape. And these people were being shipped as overseas replacements, and mostly going to Fort Ord at Monterey, and from Fort Ord being shipped out through Camp Stoneman near San Francisco to the Pacific. On the first night I was at Camp Hahn, friends of mine had driven me out to Riverside and introduced me to the man who ran the Mission Inn in Riverside. Can't think of his name right at the moment, but anyway, he said, "Would you like to live here?" And I said, I don't know, what do they permit at the camp? He said, "Oh, they're permitting officers to live off camp, if you want to live here at the Mission Inn." He said, "I know that there are three officers in room 501, and they'd like a fourth." So I said, "Well, I better go out to camp and find out about this. I just don't know whether I'd be permitted to do this." So I went out to camp, and I found out that I could live off premises. as long as I stood reveille at 5:45 in the morning, which means you had to leave Riverside at 5 or 5:15 and get out there and run like the devil and stand reveille with your unit. So I said, well, okay, I'll do that. So I joined these other three officers. And that evening we went to the room they have there, which was where there was music and you could order a drink and so forth. And there was a particularly lovely young woman playing the saxophone. And she came over. We when they had a break in the music, we asked if she would join us. And I asked a couple of the other people, I think. And that was the girl that I later married.
Oh, really interesting. What was her name?
Maxine Horton, H-O-R-T-O-N. And she had been with her family had had a family band, and of course, with so many men in the service, women were in much greater demand as musicians at that time. And so, but then she got tired of being with the family, and went out on her own. And she got this job at the Mission Inn, which was a very easy job. They only played until 11 o'clock at night, and it was the best pay that she had received yet. So she liked it, so anyway, I met her there, and we started to go together. I would come back from camp, having been up since 5 o'clock in the morning, sleep a little bit, then go down maybe a quarter of 11 or 10:30, and she'd be through, and then we'd go have a sandwich or something like that, or a salad or something, maybe stay up until midnight or something. Then I would be completely kaput, and I would go back, and then you have to get up at 5 o'clock. So I could see that I was falling in love as the time passed. And I had always thought to myself, you have very poor judgment in a situation like this, in a war, and in the army, and all of this, and you're not really in good control of your emotional life and so forth. And this is probably a big mistake. So I began to struggle against it. And I met a colonel by the name he was a mad Irishman. I'll think of it later. Anyway, one day he said to me, Block, you know my unit's alerted for overseas and I need an adjutant. And how about going with me? I said, great. I'm tired of this. I mean, you know, this cadre pool was a nightmare to operate. We had no table of organization. Nobody was going to profit by it and getting any promotion or anything. You know, I mean, it was a thankless job. So the colonel, I'm trying to think of his name, but I can't locate it now. The colonel went up to headquarters to ask for my release and be assigned to his unit. Well, we had been preparing people for overseas, completing their shots, seeing that their records were in shape, seeing that they'd been through all of the firing training and the infiltration course and all of those things this was, you know, you couldn't go overseas unless you had completed all these various things. And we had it down to a pretty good system by the time we had done one or two shipments. And we were shipping a number of troops to Fort Ord. Well, darned if the commanding general at Camp Hahn doesn't get a letter of commendation for the troops that have been transferred to Fort Ord. And he's very proud of it. And here comes Colonel, I keep thinking of Glavin, but that isn't right. Anyway, the colonel goes up there to ask for my release. And he's asked, where is he? Well, he's the personnel officer of the cadre pool. Oh, no, don't touch that. You don't touch that. We're doing too well. So he was furious. The colonel was furious. And I was disappointed. But the end result of that, of course, is that Maxine and I were married in March of, on March 23rd, 44.
End of side one, tape two, continued on side two.
A bit wrong.